January 9th, 1906. Now let me see, there was something I wanted to talk about, and I supposed it would stay in my head. I know what it is. About the big bonanza in Nevada. I want to read from the commercial columns of the New York Times of a day or two ago what practically was the beginning of the great bonanza in Nevada, and these details seem to me to be correct. That in Nevada, during 1871, John Mackey and Fair got control of the Consolidated Virginia Mine for $26,000. That in 1873, 2 years later, its 108,000 shares sold at $45 per share. And that it was at that time that Fair made the famous silver ore find of the Great Bonanza. Also, according to these statistics, in November 74, the stock went to 115, and in the following month suddenly jumped up to 610, and in the next month, January 75, it reached 700. The shares of the companion mine, the California, rose in 4 months from 37 to 780, a total property which in 1869 was valued on the mining exchange at $40,000, was quoted 6 years later at $160 million. I think those dates are correct. That great bonanza occupies a rather prominent place in my mind for the reason that I knew persons connected with it. For instance, I knew John Mackey very well. That would be in 1862, 63, and 64, I should say. I don't remember what he was doing when I came to Virginia in 1862 from starving to death down in the so-called mines of Esmeralda, which consisted in that day merely of silver-bearing quartz, plenty of bearing, and didn't have much load to carry in the way of silver. And it was a happy thing for me when I was summoned to come up to Virginia City to be local editor of the Virginia City Enterprise during 3 months, while Mr. William H. Wright should go east to Iowa and visit his family, whom he hadn't seen for some years. I took the position of local editor with joy because there was a salary of $40 a week attached to it, and I judged that that was all of $39 more than I was worth. And I'd always wanted a position which paid in the opposite proportion of value to amount of work. I took that position with pleasure, not with confidence, but I had a difficult job. I was to furnish one column of leaded nonpareil every day, and as much more as I could get on paper before the paper should go to press at 2 o'clock in the morning. By and by, in the course of a few months, I met John Mackey, with whom I'd already been well acquainted for some time. He had established a broker's office on C Street in a new frame house, and it was rather sumptuous for that day and place, for it had part of a carpet on the floor and two chairs instead of a candle box. I was envious of Mackey, who had not been in such very smooth circumstances as this before, and I offered to trade places with him, take his business and let him have mine. And he asked me how much mine was worth. I said $40 a week. He said, "I never swindled anybody in my life, and I don't want to begin with you. This business of mine is not worth $40 a week. You stay where you are, and I will try to get a living out of this." I left Nevada in 1864 to avoid a term in the penitentiary. In another chapter, I shall have to explain that. So that it was all of 10 years, apparently, before John Mackey developed suddenly into the first of the 100 millionaires. Apparently, his prosperity began in 71. That discovery was made in 71. I know how it was made. I remember those details, for they came across the country to me in Hartford. There was a tunnel, 1,700 feet long, which struck in from way down on the slope of the mountain and passed under some portion of Virginia City, at a great depth. It was striking for a lode which it did not find, and I think the search had been long abandoned. Now, in groping around in that abandoned tunnel, Mr. Fair, afterwards U.S. Senator and multimillionaire, came across a body of rich ore, so the story ran, and he came and reported his find to John Mackey. They examined this treasure and found that there was a very great deposit of it. They prospected it in the usual way and proved its magnitude, and that it was extremely rich. They thought it was a chimney, belonging probably to the California, away up on the mountainside, which had an abandoned shaft, or possibly the Virginia mine, which was not worked then, nobody caring anything about the Virginia, an empty mine. These men determined that this body of ore properly belonged to the California mine, and by some trick of nature had been shaken down the mountainside. They got O'Brien, who was a silver expert in San Francisco, to come in as capitalist, and they bought up a controlling interest in the abandoned claims, and no doubt got it at that figure, $26,000. 6 years later, to be worth $160 million. As I say, I was not there. I'd been here in the East 6, 7, or 8 years, but friends of mine were interested. John P. Jones, who has lately resigned as U.S. Senator after an uninterrupted term of perhaps 30 years, was living in San Francisco. He had a great affection for a couple of old friends of mine, Joseph T. Goodman and Dennis McCarthy. They had been proprietors of that paper that I served, the Virginia City Enterprise, and they had enjoyed great prosperity in that position. They were young journeyman printers, typesetting in San Francisco in 1858, and they went over the Sierras when they heard of the discovery of silver in that unknown region of Nevada to push their fortunes. When they arrived at that miserable little camp, Virginia City, they had no money to push their fortunes with. They had only youth, energy, hope. They found Williams there. Stud Williams was his society name, who had started a weekly newspaper, and he had one journeyman who set up the paper and printed it on a hand press with Williams's help and the help of a Chinaman. They all slept in one room, cooked and slept and worked, and disseminated intelligence in this paper of theirs. Well, Williams was in debt $14. He didn't see any way to get out of it with his newspaper, and so he sold the paper to Dennis McCarthy and Goodman for $200. They to assume the debt of $14 and also pay the $200 in this world or the next. There was no definite arrangement about that. But as Virginia City developed, new mines were discovered, new people began to flock in, and there was talk of a Faro Bank and a church and all those things that go to make a frontier Christian city. There was vast prosperity, and Goodman and Dennis reaped the advantage of it. Their own prosperity was so great that they built a 3-story brick building, which was a wonderful thing for that town. And their business increased so mightily that they would often plant out 11 columns of new ads per day on a standing galley and leave them there to sleep and rest and breed income. When any man objected, after searching the paper in the hope of seeing his advertisement, they would say, "We are doing the best we can." Now and then the advertisements would appear, but the standing galley was doing its money-coining work all the time. But after a while, Nevada Territory was turned into a state in order to furnish office for some people who needed office. And by and by, the paper, from paying those boys $20,000 to $40,000 a year, ceased to pay anything. I suppose they were glad to get rid of it, and probably on the old terms, to some journeyman who was willing to take the old $14 indebtedness and pay it when he could. These boys went down to San Francisco setting type again. They were delightful fellows, always ready for a good time, and that meant that everybody got their money except themselves. And when the bonanza was about to be discovered, Joe Goodman arrived here from somewhere that he'd been, I suppose trying to make business or a livelihood or something, and he came to see me to borrow $300 to take him out to San Francisco. And, if I remember rightly, he had no prospect in front of him at all, but thought he would be more likely to find it out there among the old friends, and he went to San Francisco. He arrived there just in time to meet Jones, afterwards U.S. Senator, who was a delightful man. Jones met him and said privately, "There's been a great discovery made in Nevada, and I am on the inside." Dennis was setting type in one of the offices there. He was married and was building a wooden house to cost $1,800, and he had paid a part and was building it on installments out of his wages. And Jones said, "I'm going to put you and Dennis in privately on the big bonanza. I am on the inside. I will watch it, and we will put this money up on a margin. Therefore, when I say it is time to sell, it will be very necessary to sell." So he put up 20% margins for those two boys, and that is the time when this great spurt must have happened, which sent that stock up to the stars in one flight. Because, as the history was told to me by Joe Goodman, when that thing happened, Jones said to Goodman and Dennis, "Now then, sell. You can come out $600,000 ahead, each of you, and that is enough. Sell." "No," Joe objected, "it will go higher." Jones said, "I am on the inside, you are not. Sell." Joe's wife implored him to sell. He wouldn't do it. Dennis's family implored him to sell. Dennis wouldn't sell. And so it went on during 2 weeks. Each time the stock made a flight, Jones tried to get the boys to sell. They wouldn't do it. They said, "It's going higher." When he said, "Sell at 900,000, they said, "No, it will go to 1 million." Then the stock began to go down very rapidly. After a little, Joe sold and he got out with $600,000 cash. Dennis waited for 1 million, but he never got a cent. His holding was sold for the mud, so that he came out without anything and had to begin again setting type. That is the story as it was told to me many years ago. I imagine by Joe Goodman, I don't remember now. Dennis, by and by, died poor, never got a start again. Joe Goodman immediately went into the broker business. $600,000 was just good capital. He wasn't in a position to retire yet. And he sent me the $300 and said that now he had started in the broking business and that he was making an abundance of money. I didn't hear any more then for a long time. Then I learned that he had not been content with mere broking, but had speculated on his own account and lost everything he had. And when that happened, John Mackey, who was always a good friend of the unfortunate, lent him $4,000 to buy a grape ranch with in Fresno County, and Joe went up there. He didn't know anything about the grape culture, but he and his wife learned it in a very little while. He learned it a little better than anybody else and got a good living out of it until 1886 or 87. Then he sold it for several times what he paid for it originally. He was here a year ago and I saw him. He lives in the Garden of California in Alameda. Before this eastern visit, he had been putting in 12 years of his time in the most unpromising and difficult and stubborn study that anybody has undertaken since Champollion's time. For he undertook to find out what those sculptures mean that they find down there in the forests of Central America. And he did find out, and published a great book, the result of his 12 years of study. In this book he furnishes the meanings of those hieroglyphs. And his position as a successful expert in that complex study is recognized by the scientists in that line in London and Berlin and elsewhere. But he is no better known than he was before. He is known only to those people. His book was published in about 1901. This account in the New York Times says that in consequence of that strike in the Great Bonanza, a tempest of speculation ensued, and that the group of mines right around that center reached a value in the stock market of close upon $400 million. And 6 months after that, that value had been reduced by three-quarters. And by 1880, 5 years later, the stock of the Consolidated Virginia was under $2 a share, and the stock in the California was only $1.75, for the Bonanza was now confessedly exhausted. January 10, 1906. I have to make several speeches within the next 2 or 3 months, and I've been obliged to make a few speeches during the last 2 months. And all of a sudden, it is borne in upon me that people who go out that way to make speeches at gatherings of one kind or another, and at social banquets particularly, put themselves to an unnecessary amount of trouble often in the way of preparation. As a rule, your speech at a social banquet is not an important part of your equipment for that occasion, for the reason that, as a rule, the banquet is merely given to celebrate some event of merely momentary interest, or to do honor to some guest of distinction. And so there is nothing of large consequence, nothing, I mean, that one should feel bound to concentrate himself upon in talking upon such an occasion. Whereas the really important matter, perhaps, is that the speaker make himself reasonably interesting while he is on his feet, and avoid wearying and exasperating the people who are not privileged to make speeches, and also not privileged to get out of the way when other people begin. So, common charity for those people should require that the speaker make some kind of preparation instead of going to the place absolutely empty. The person who makes frequent speeches can't afford much time for their preparation, and he probably goes to that place empty, just as I'm in the habit of doing, purposing to gather texts from other unprepared people who are going to speak before he speaks. Now, it is perfectly true that if you can get yourself located along about number 3, and from that lower down on the program, it can be depended on with certainty that one or another of those previous speakers will furnish all the texts needed. In fact, you are likely to have more texts than you do need, and so they can become an embarrassment You would like to talk to all of those texts, and of course that is a dangerous thing. You should choose one of them and talk to that one. And it is 100 to 1 that before you have been on your feet 2 minutes, you will wish you had taken the other one. You will get away from the one you have chosen because you will perceive that there was another one that was better. I am reminded of this old, old fact in my experience by what happened the other night at the Players, where 22 of my friends of ancient days in the Players Club gave me a dinner in testimony of their satisfaction in having me back again after an absence of 3 years, occasioned by the stupidity of the board of management of that club, a board which had been in office ever since the founding of the club. And if it were not the same old board that they had in the beginning, it amounted to the same, because they must have been chosen from time to time from the same asylum that had furnished the original board. On this occasion, Brander Matthews was chairman, and he opened the proceedings with an easy and comfortable and felicitous speech. Brander is always prepared and competent when he is going to make a speech. Then he called up Gilder, who came empty, and probably supposed he was going to be able to fill from Brander's tank, whereas he struck a disappointment. He labored through and sat down not entirely defeated, but a good deal crippled. Frank Millet, painter, was next called up. He struggled along through his remarks, exhibiting two things. One, that he had prepared and couldn't remember the details of his preparation, and the other, that his text was a poor text. In his talk, the main sign of preparation was that he tried to recite 2 considerable batches of poetry, good poetry, but he lost confidence and turned it into bad poetry by bad recitation. Sculpture was to have been represented, and St. Gaudens had accepted and had promised a speech, but at the last moment he was not able to come, and a man who was thoroughly unprepared had to get up and make a speech in St. Gaudens's place. He did not hit upon anything original or disturbing in his remarks, and in fact they were so tottering and hesitating and altogether commonplace that really he seemed to have hit upon something new and fresh when he finished by saying that he had not been expecting to be called upon to make a speech. I could have finished his speech for him. I had heard it so many times. Those people were unfortunate because they were thinking, that is, Millet and Gilder were, all the time that Matthews was speaking. They were trying to keep in mind the little preparations which they had made, and this prevented them from getting something new and fresh in the way of a text out of what Brander was saying. In the same way, Millet was still thinking about his preparation while Gilder was talking, and so he overlooked possible texts furnished by Gilder. But as I had asked Matthews to put me last on the list of speakers, I had all the advantages possible to the occasion. For I came without a text, and these boys furnished plenty of texts for me, because my mind was not absorbed in trying to remember my preparations. They didn't exist. I spoiled, in a degree, Brander's speech, because his speech had been prepared with direct reference to introducing me, the guest of the occasion, and he had to turn that all around and get out of it, which he did very gracefully, explaining that his speech was a little lopsided and wrong end first, because I had asked to be placed last in the list of speakers. I had a plenty good enough time because Gilder had furnished me a text. Brander had furnished me a text. Millet had furnished me a text. These texts were fresh, hot from the bat, and they produced the same eager disposition to take hold of them and talk that they would have produced in ordinary conversation around a table in a beer mill. Now then, I know how banquet speeches should be projected because I've been thinking over this matter. This is my plan. Where it is merely a social banquet for a good time, such as the one which I am to attend in Washington on the 27th, where the company will consist of the membership of the Gridiron Club, newspaper correspondents exclusively, I think, with as guests the President and Vice President of the United States and 2 others, certainly that is an occasion where a person will be privileged to talk about any subject except politics and theology. And even if he is asked to talk to a toast, he needn't pay any attention to the toast, but talk about anything. Now then, the idea is this: to take the newspaper of that day, or the newspaper of that evening, and glance over the headings in the telegraphic page, a perfect bonanza of texts, you see. I think a person could pull that day's newspaper out of his pocket and talk that company to death before he would run out of material. If it were today, you have the Morris incident. And that reminds me how unexciting the Morris incident will be 2 or 3 years from now, maybe 6 months from now. And yet, What an irritating thing it is today, and has been for the past few days. It brings home to one this large fact, that the events of life are mainly small events. They only seem large when we are close to them. By and by they settle down and we see that one doesn't show above another. They are all about one general low altitude and inconsequential. If you should set down every day by shorthand, as we are doing now, the happenings of the previous day, with the intention of making out of the massed result an autobiography, it would take from 1 to 2 hours, and from that to 4 hours, to set down the autobiographical matter of that one day, and the result would be a consumption of from 5 to 40,000 words. It would be a volume. Now, one must not imagine that because it has taken all day Tuesday to write up the autobiographical matter of Monday, there will be nothing to write on Wednesday. No, there will be just as much to write on Wednesday as Monday had furnished for Tuesday. And that is because life does not consist mainly, or even largely, of facts and happenings. It consists mainly of the storm of thoughts that is forever blowing through one's head. Could you set them down stenographically? No. Could you set down any considerable fraction of them stenographically? No. 15 stenographers hard at work couldn't keep up. Therefore, a full autobiography has never been written, and it never will be. It would consist of 365 double-sized volumes per year. And so, if I'd been doing my whole autobiographical duty ever since my youth, all the library buildings on the earth could not contain the result. I wonder what the Morris incident will look like in history 50 years from now. Consider these circumstances, that here at our own doors the mighty insurance upheaval has not settled down to a level yet. Even yesterday and day before, the discredited millionaire insurance magnates had not all been flung out and buried from sight under the maledictions of the nation, but some of the McCurdys, McCalls, Depews, Hydes, and Alexanders were still lingering in positions of trust, such as directorships in banks. Also, we have today the whole nation's attention centered upon the Standard Oil Corporation, the most prodigious commercial force existing upon the planet. All the American world are standing breathless and wondering if the Standard Oil is going to come out of its Missourian battle crippled, and if crippled, how much crippled. Also, we have Congress threatening to overhaul the Panama Canal Commission to see what it has done with the 59 millions, and to find out what it proposes to do with the recently added 11 millions. Also, there are 3 or 4 other matters of colossal public interest on the board today. And on the other side of the ocean, we have church and state separated in France. We have a threat of war between France and Germany upon the Morocco question. We have a crushed revolution in Russia, with the Tsar and his family of thieves, the Grand Dukes, recovering from their long fright and beginning to butcher the remnants of the revolutionaries in the old confident way that was the Russian way in former days for 3 centuries. We have China furnishing a solemn and awful mystery. Nobody knows what it is, but we are sending 3 regiments in a hurry from the Philippines to China, under the generalship of Funston, the man who captured Aguinaldo by methods which would disgrace the lowest blatherskite that is doing time in any penitentiary. Nobody seems to know what the Chinese mystery is, but everybody seems to think that a giant convulsion is impending there. That is the menu as it stands today. These are the things which offer themselves to the world's attention today. Apparently they are large enough to leave no space for smaller matters, yet the Morris incident comes up and blots the whole thing out. The Morris incident is making a flurry in Congress, and for several days now it has been rioting through the imagination of the American nation and setting every tongue afire with excited talk. This autobiography will not see the light of print until after my death. I do not know when that is going to happen, and do not feel a large interest in the matter anyway. It may be some years yet, but if it does not occur within the next 3 months, I am confident that by that time the nation, encountering the Morris incident in my autobiography, would be trying to remember what the incident was and not succeeding. That incident, which is so large today, will be so small 3 or 4 months from now, it will then have taken its place with the abortive Russian Revolution and these other large matters, and nobody will be able to tell one from the other by difference of size. This is the Morris incident. A Mrs. Morris, a lady of culture, refinement, and position, called at the White House and asked for a moment's conversation with President Roosevelt. Mr. Barnes, one of the private secretaries, declined to send in her card and said that she couldn't see the president, that he was busy. She said she would wait. Barnes wanted to know what her errand was, and she said that some time ago her husband had been dismissed from the public service, and she wanted to get the president to look into his case. Barnes, finding that it was a military case, suggested that she go to the Secretary of War. She said she had been to the War Office but could not get admission to the secretary. She had tried every means she could think of, but had failed. Now she had been advised by the wife of a member of the cabinet to ask for a moment's interview with the president. Well, without going into a multiplicity of details, the general result was that Barnes still persisted in saying that she could not see the president, and he also persisted in inviting her, in the circumstances, to go away. She was quiet, but she still insisted on remaining until she could see the president. Then the Morris incident happened. At a sign from Barnes, a couple of policemen on guard there rushed forward and seized this lady and began to drag her out of the place. She was frightened, and she screamed. Barnes says she screamed repeatedly and in a way which aroused the whole White House, though nobody came to see what was happening. This might give the impression that this was something that was happening 6 or 7 times a day, since it didn't cause any excitement. But this was not so. Barnes has been a private secretary long enough to work his imagination, probably, and that accounts for most of the screaming, though the lady did some of it herself, as she concedes. The woman was dragged out of the White House. She says that in the course of dragging her along the roadway, her clothes were soiled with mud and some of them stripped in rags from her back. A Negro gathered up her ankles and so relieved her from contact with the ground. He supporting her by the ankles and the 2 policemen carrying her at the other end, they conveyed her to a place, apparently a police station of some kind, a couple of blocks away, and she was dripping portemonnaies and keys and one thing or another along the road, and honest people were picking them up and fetching them along. Barnes entered a charge against her of insanity. Apparently the police inspector regarded that as rather a serious charge, and as he probably had not had one like it before and did not quite know how it ought to be handled, he would not allow her to be delivered to her friends until she had deposited $5 in his till. No doubt this was to keep her from disappearing from the United States, and he might want to take up this serious charge presently and thresh it out. That lady still lies in her bed at the principal hotel in Washington, disabled by the shock and naturally very indignant at the treatment which she has received. But her calm and mild, unexcited, and well-worded account of her adventure is convincing evidence that she was not insane, even to the moderate extent of $5 worth. There you have the facts. It is as I have said. For a number of days they have occupied almost the entire attention of the American nation. They have swept the Russian Revolution out of sight, the China mystery, and all the rest of it. It is this sort of thing which makes the right material of an autobiography. You set the incident down, which for the moment is to you the most interesting. If you leave it alone 3 or 4 weeks, you wonder why you ever thought of setting such a thing down. It has no value, no importance. The champagne that made you drunk with delight or exasperation at the time has all passed away. It is stale. But that is what human life consists of, little incidents and big incidents. And they are all of the same size if we let them alone. An autobiography that leaves out the little things and enumerates only the big ones is no proper picture of the man's life at all. His life consists of his feelings and his interests, with here and there an incident apparently big or little to hang the feelings on. That Morris incident will presently have no importance whatever, and yet the biographer of President Roosevelt will find it immensely valuable if he will consider it, examine it, and be sagacious enough to perceive that it throws a great deal of light upon the president's character. Certainly a biography's chiefest feature is the exhibition of the character of the man whose biography is being set forth. Roosevelt's biographer will light up the president's career step by step, mile after mile, through his life's course, with illuminating episodes and incidents. He should set one of the lamps by the Morris incident, for it indicates character. It is a thing which probably could not have happened in the White House under any other president who has ever occupied those premises. Washington wouldn't call the police and throw a lady out over the fence. I don't mean that Roosevelt would. I mean, Washington wouldn't have had any Barneses in his official family. It is the Roosevelts that have the Barneses around. That private secretary was perfectly right in refusing access to the president. The president can't see everybody on everybody's private affairs, and it is quite proper, then, that he should refuse to see anybody on a private affair. Treat all the nation alike. That is a thing which has been done, of course, from the beginning until now. People have always been refused admission to the president on private matters, every day, from Washington's time to ours. The secretaries have always carried their point. Mr. Barnes carried his. But according to the president in office at the time, the methods have varied. One president's secretary has managed it in one way, another president's secretary has managed it in another way, but it never would have occurred to any previous secretary to manage it by throwing the lady over the fence. Theodore Roosevelt is one of the most impulsive men in existence. That is the reason why he has impulsive secretaries. President Roosevelt probably never thinks of the right way to do anything. That is why he has private secretaries who are not able to think of the right way to do anything. We naturally gather about us people whose ways and dispositions agree with our own. Mr. Roosevelt is one of the most likable men that I am acquainted with. I have known him and have occasionally met him, dined in his company, lunched in his company, for certainly 20 years. I always enjoy his society. He is so hearty, so straightforward, outspoken, and so absolutely sincere. These qualities endear him to me when he is acting in his capacity of private citizen. They endear him to all his friends. But when he is acting under their impulse as president, they make of him a sufficiently queer president. He flies from one thing to another with incredible dispatch, throws a somersault, and is straightaway back again where he was last week. He will then throw some more somersaults, and nobody can foretell where he is finally going to land after the series. Each act of his, and each opinion expressed, is likely to abolish or controvert some previous act or expressed opinion. This is what is happening to him all the time as president. But every opinion that he expresses is certainly his sincere opinion at that moment, and it is as certainly not the opinion which he was carrying around in his system 3 or 4 weeks earlier, and which was just as sincere and honest as the latest one. No, he can't be accused of insincerity. That is not the trouble. His trouble is that his newest interest is the one that absorbs him, absorbs the whole of him, from his head to his feet. And for the time being, it annihilates all previous opinions and feelings and convictions. He is the most popular human being that has ever existed in the United States, and that popularity springs from just these enthusiasms of his, these joyous ebullitions of excited sincerity. It makes him so much like the rest of the people. They see themselves reflected in him. They also see that his impulses are not often mean. They are almost always large, fine, generous. He can't stick to one of them long enough to find out what kind of a chick it would hatch if it had a chance, but everybody recognizes the generosity of the intention, and they admire it and love him for it. January 11th, 1906. I received the following letter some days ago from Mrs. Laura K. Hudson. 287 Quincy Street, January 3rd, '06. Mr. Samuel L. Clemens. My dear sir, some 20 years ago we were in the first years of our married life. The first two small installments of a growing family kept us severely domestic, and my husband and I used to spend our happy evenings together, he reading aloud from magazine or book, and I meanwhile sewing and listening. One evening he read from one of the New York papers the report of some function. I have a hazy idea it was a press club dinner or other jamboree, during which Mark Twain read aloud a paper which to me seemed the best and funniest thing our great favorite had ever written. And now that the growing family has gotten its growth and has grown very fond of Mark Twain, I have searched high and low in every collection of his works for this delightful bit of fun, but always in vain. May I therefore apply to Mr. Clemens for some help? It was about a miner in his mountain hut, to whom come 3 men for food and a night's shelter. They give their names as Longfellow, Holmes, and Whittier, and the way they are described, the last mentioned with double chins way down to his stomach, by the miner who tells the story, And the high-flown quotations from their own writings which they give in answer to the miners' very gruff and to-the-point questions are fun of the funniest kind. The miner stands it until, in answer to some self-satisfied remark of his in reference to his comfortable cabin, the pseudo-Holmes retorts, "Build thee more stately mansions, O my soul," and so on through the entire stanza. Then he rises in his wrath and puts the three poets out. Any light you can throw on the name and possible whereabouts of this delightful child of your muse will be most gratefully received by my husband, my three sons, and their Mark Twain-loving mother, who begs leave to call herself, yours most cordially, Laura K. Hudson. This morning I dictated an answer to my secretary, Miss Lyon, as follows. Dear Mrs. Hudson, I am forever your debtor for reminding me of that curious passage in my life. During the first year or two after it happened, I could not bear to think of it. My pain and shame were so intense, and my sense of having been an imbecile so settled, established, and confirmed, that I drove the episode entirely from my mind. And so all these 28 or 29 years I have lived in the conviction that my performance of that time was coarse, vulgar, and destitute of humor. But your suggestion that you and your family found humor in it 28 years ago moved me to look into the matter. So I commissioned a Boston typewriter to delve among the Boston papers of that bygone time and sent me a copy of it. It came this morning, and if there is any vulgarity about it, I am not able to discover it. If it isn't innocently and ridiculously funny, I am no judge. I will see to it that you get a copy. Address of Samuel L. Clemens, Mark Twain, from a report of the dinner given by the publishers of the Atlantic Monthly in honor of the 70th anniversary of the birth of John Greenleaf Whittier at the Hotel Brunswick, Boston, December 17, 1877, as published in the Boston Evening Transcript, December 18, 1877. Mr. Chairman, this is an occasion peculiarly meet for the digging up of pleasant reminiscences concerning literary folk. Therefore, I will drop lightly into history myself. Standing here on the shore of the Atlantic and contemplating certain of its largest literary billows, I am reminded of a thing which happened to me 13 years ago, when I had just succeeded in stirring up a little Nevadian literary puddle myself, whose spume flakes were beginning to blow thinly California-wards. I started an inspection tramp through the southern mines of California. I was callow and conceited, and I resolved to try the virtue of my nom de guerre. I very soon had an opportunity. I knocked at a miner's lonely log cabin in the foothills of the Sierras just at nightfall. It was snowing at the time. A jaded, melancholy man of 50, barefooted, opened to me. When he heard my nom de guerre, he looked more dejected than before. He let me in, pretty reluctantly, I thought, and after the customary bacon and beans, black coffee, and a hot whiskey, I took a pipe. This sorrowful man had not said 3 words up to this time. Now he spoke up and said in the voice of one who is secretly suffering, "You're the fourth. I'm a-going to move." "The fourth what?" said I. "The fourth literary man has been here in 24 hours. I'm a-going to move."
"You don't tell me," said I. "Who are the others?"
"Mr. Longfellow, Mr. Emerson, and Mr. Oliver Wendell Holmes. Consound the lot!" You can easily believe I was interested. I supplicated. 3 hot whiskies did the rest. And finally the melancholy miner began. Said he, "They came here just at dark yesterday evening, and I let them in, of course. Said they were going to Yosemite. They were a rough lot, but that's nothing. Everybody looks rough that travels afoot. Mr. Emerson was a seedy little bit of a chap, red-headed. Mr. Holmes was as fat as a balloon. He weighed as much as 300 and had double chins all the way down to his stomach. Mr. Longfellow was built like a prize-fighter. His head was cropped and bristly, like as if he had a wig made of hairbrushes. His nose lay straight down his face, like a finger with the end joint tilted up. They had been drinking, I could see that. And what queer talk they used! Mr. Holmes inspected this cabin, then he took me by the buttonhole, and says he, 'Through the deep caves of thought I hear a voice that sings, Build thee more stately mansions, O my soul!'
Says I can't afford it, Mr. Holmes, and moreover, I don't want to. Blamed if I liked it pretty well either, coming from a stranger that way. However, I started to get out my bacon and beans when Mr. Emerson came and looked on a while, and then he takes me aside by the buttonhole and says, "Give me agates for my meat. Give me cantharids to eat. From air and ocean bring me foods from all zones and altitudes." Says I, "Mr. Emerson, if you'll excuse me, this ain't no hotel." You see, it sort of riled me. I weren't used to the ways of literary swells. But I went on a-sweatin' over my work, and next comes Mr. Longfellow and buttonholes me and interrupts me. Says he, "Honor be to Mujikiwis. You shall hear how Pow Pukiwis." But I broke in and says I, "Beggin' your pardon, Mr. Longfellow, if you'll be so kind as to hold your yop for about 5 minutes and let me get this grub ready, you'll do me proud." Well, sir, after they'd filled up, I set out the jug. Mr. Holmes looks at it, and then he fires up all of a sudden and yells, "Flash out a stream of blood-red wine, for I would drink to other days." By George, I was getting kind of worked up. I don't deny it, I was getting kind of worked up. I turns to Mr. Holmes and says, "I, looky here, my fat friend. I'm a-running this shanty, and if the court knows herself, you'll take whiskey straight or you'll go dry." Them's the very words I said to him. Now, I didn't want to sass such famous literary people, but you see, they kind of forced me. There ain't nothing unreasonable about me. I don't mind a passel of guests a-treading on my tail 3 or 4 times, but when it comes to standing on it, it's different. "And if the court knows herself," I says, "you'll take whiskey straight or you'll go dry." Well, between drinks, they'd swell around the cabin and strike attitudes and spout. Says Mr. Longfellow, "This is the forest primeval." Says Mr. Emerson, "Here once the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world." Says I, "Oh, blaggard the premises as much as you want to. It don't cost a cent." Well, they went on drinking, and pretty soon they got out a greasy old deck and went to playing euchre at 10 cents a corner, on trust. I begun to notice some pretty suspicious things. Mr. Emerson dealt, looked at his hand, shook his head, says, "I am the doubter and the doubt," and calmly bunched the hands and went to shuffling for a new layout. Says he, "They reckon ill who leave me out. They know not well the subtle ways I keep. I pass and deal again." Hanged if he didn't go ahead and do it, too. Oh, he was a cool one. Well, in about a minute, things were running pretty tight, but all of a sudden, I see by Mr. Emerson's eye that he judged he had 'em. He had already corralled 2 tricks, and each of the others won. So now he kind of lifts a little in his chair and says, "I tire of globes and aces. Too long the game is played." And down he fetched a right bower. Mr. Longfellow smiles as sweet as pie and says, "Thanks, thanks to thee, my worthy friend, for the lesson thou hast taught." And blamed if he didn't down with another right bower. Well, sir, up jumps Holmes, a war whooping as usual, and says, "God help them if the tempest swings the pine against the palm." And I wish I may go to grass if he didn't swoop down with another right bower. Emerson claps his hand on his buoy, Longfellow claps his on his revolver, and I went under a bunk. There was going to be trouble, but that monstrous Holmes rose up, wobbling his double chins, and says he, "Order, gentlemen. The first man that draws, I'll lay down on him and smother him." All quiet on the Potomac, you bet. They were pretty how-come-you-so by now, and they begun to blow. Emerson says, "The nobbiest thing I ever wrote was Barbara Fritchie." Says Longfellow, "It don't begin with my Bigelow papers." Says Holmes, "My Thanatopsis lays over 'em both." They mighty near ended in a fight. Then they wished they had some more company, and Mr. Emerson pointed at me and says, "Is yonder squalid peasant all that this proud nursery could breed?" He was a-wetting his buoy on his boot, so I let it pass. Well, sir, next thing they took it into their heads that they would like some music. So they made me stand up and sing "When Johnny Comes Marching Home" till I dropped. At 4:13 this morning. That's what I've been through, my friend. When I woke at 7, they were leaving, thank goodness, and Mr. Longfellow had my only boots on and his'n under his arm. Says I, "Hold on there, Evangeline, what are you going to do with them?" He says, going to make tracks with them, because lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime, and departing leave behind us footprints on the sands of time.
As I said, Mr. Twain, you are the 4th in 24 hours, and I'm a-going to move. I ain't suited to a literary atmosphere. I said to the miner, "Why, my dear sir, these were not the gracious singers to whom we in the world pay loving reverence and homage. These were impostors." The miner investigated me with a calm eye for a while. Then said he, "Ah, impostors, were they? Are you?" I did not pursue the subject, and since then I haven't traveled on my nom de guerre enough to hurt. Such was the reminiscence I was moved to contribute, Mr. Chairman. In my enthusiasm, I may have exaggerated the details a little, but you will easily forgive me that fault, since I believe it is the first time I have ever deflected from perpendicular fact on an occasion like this. What I have said to Mrs. Hudson is true. I did suffer during a year or two from the deep humiliations of that episode. But at last, in 1878, in Venice, my wife and I came across Mr. and Mrs. A.P. Chamberlain of Concord, Massachusetts, and a friendship began then of the sort which nothing but death terminates. The Chamberlains were very bright people, and in every way charming and companionable. We were together a month or two in Venice, and several months in Rome afterwards, and one day that lamented break of mine was mentioned. And when I was on the point of lathering those people for bringing it to my mind, when I had gotten the memory of it almost squelched, I perceived with joy that the Chamberlains were indignant about the way that my performance had been received in Boston. They poured out their opinions most freely and frankly about the frosty attitude of the people who were present at that performance, and about the Boston newspapers for the position they had taken in regard to the matter. That position was that I had been irreverent beyond belief, beyond imagination. Very well, I had accepted that as a fact for a year or two, and had been thoroughly miserable about it whenever I thought of it, which was not frequently, if I could help it. Whenever I thought of it, I wondered how I ever could have been inspired to do so unholy a thing. Well, the Chamberlains comforted me, but they did not persuade me to continue to think about the unhappy episode. I resisted that. I tried to get it out of my mind and let it die, and I succeeded. Until Mrs. Hudson's letter came the other day, it had been a good 25 years since I had thought of that matter, and when she said that the thing was funny, I wondered if possibly she might be right. At any rate, my curiosity was aroused, and I wrote to Boston and got the whole thing copied, as above set forth. I vaguely remember some of the details of that gathering. Dimly I can see 100 people, no, perhaps 50, shadowy figures sitting at tables feeding, ghosts now to me and nameless forevermore. I don't know who they were, but I can very distinctly see seated at the grand table and facing the rest of us, Mr. Emerson, supernaturally grave, unsmiling, Mr. Whittier, grave, lovely, his beautiful spirit shining out of his face, a Quaker but smiley and sweet, Mr. Longfellow with his silken white hair and his benignant face, Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes, flashing smiles and affection and all good fellowship everywhere, like a rose diamond whose facets are being turned toward the light first one way and then another. A charming man, and always fascinating, whether he was talking or whether he was sitting still, what he would call still, but what would be more or less motion to other people. I can see those figures with entire distinctness across this abyss of time. One other feature is clear. Willie Winter, for these past 1,000 years, dramatic editor of the New York Tribune and still occupying that high post in his old age, was there. He was much younger than he is now, and he showed it. It was always a pleasure to me to see Willie Winter at a banquet. During a matter of 20 years, I was seldom at a banquet where Willie Winter was not also present, and where he did not read a charming poem written for the occasion. He did it this time, and it was up to standard. There was never any vigor in his poetry, but it was always smooth, wavy, and dainty, happy, choicely phrased, and as good to listen to as music. And he did love to recite those occasional poems, with a love that is beyond understanding. There was no doubt of his joy in the performance. His delight in it was absolutely innocent. His unoffending admiration of his poems, his perfect manner of reading them, it was all beautiful to see.
He recited from memory sometimes, a very long speech, exquisitely phrased, faultlessly modeled, yet sounding exactly as if it was pouring unprepared out of heart and brain. He was a perfect reciter of both his poetry and his prose, and in both instances they were music. But if he was well down in the list of performers, then his performance was worth two or three times as much as it was when he was appointed to enter the field earlier. Because if he was down a little way in the list, it gave him a chance to drink a thimbleful of champagne. And that was all that was necessary for Willie Winter. I can see him so clearly. His small figure bent persuasively forward, his face glowing with inspiration, part of it from his poetry, the rest from his thimbleful of champagne. He would throw out a dainty line or two and then glance up this way, that way, the other way, collecting appreciation. And in the meantime, he would be not spitting, that is vulgar, but doing what any man properly charged with champagne does when he feels that he has got his mouth full of raw cotton and must rid himself of it. He did that all the way through while he was reciting, and he was the happiest man in the world. And on this particular occasion that I am speaking of, he was charming. It was a beautiful thing to see, and I wished he was drunker. He got such effects out of that thimbleful of champagne, I wondered what would happen if he had had a tubful. Now, at that point ends all that was pleasurable about that notable celebration of Mr. Whittier's 70th birthday, because I got up at that point and followed Winter, with what I have no doubt I supposed would be the gem of the evening, the gay oration above quoted from the Boston paper. I had written it all out the day before and had perfectly memorized it, and I stood up there at my genial and happy and self-satisfied ease and began to deliver it. Those majestic guests, that row of venerable and still active volcanoes, listened, as did everybody else in the house, with attentive interest. Well, I delivered myself of, we'll say, the first 200 words of my speech. I was expecting no returns from that part of the speech, but this was not the case as regarded the rest of it. I arrived now at the dialogue. The old miner said, "You are the fourth. I'm going to move." "The fourth what?" said I. He answered, "The fourth literary man that has been here in 24 hours. I am going to move." "Why, you don't tell me," said I. "Who were the others?" "Mr. Longfellow, Mr. Emerson, Mr. Oliver Wendell Holmes. Consound the lot." Now then, the house's attention continued, but the expression of interest in the faces turned to a sort of black frost. I wondered what the trouble was. I didn't know. I went on, but with difficulty. I struggled along and entered upon that miner's fearful description of the bogus Emerson, the bogus Holmes, the bogus Longfellow, always hoping, but with a gradually perishing hope, that somebody would laugh or that somebody would at least smile, but nobody did. I didn't know enough to give it up and sit down. I was too new to public speaking, and so I went on with this awful performance and carried it clear through to the end, in front of a body of people who seemed turned to stone with horror. It was the sort of expression their faces would have worn if I had been making these remarks about the deity and the rest of the Trinity. There is no milder way in which to describe the petrified condition and the ghastly expression of those people. When I sat down, it was with a heart which had long ceased to beat. I shall never be as dead again as I was then. I shall never be as miserable again as I was then. I speak now as one who doesn't know what the condition of things may be in the next world, but in this one I shall never be as wretched again as I was then. Howells, who was near me, tried to say a comforting word, but couldn't get beyond a gasp. There was no use. He understood the whole size of the disaster. He had good intentions, but the words froze before they could get out. It was an atmosphere that would freeze anything. If Benvenuto Cellini's Salamander had been in that place, he would not have survived to be put into Cellini's autobiography. There was a frightful pause. There was an awful silence, a desolating silence. Then the next man on the list had to get up. There was no help for it. That was Bishop. Bishop, now forgotten, had just burst handsomely upon the world with a most acceptable novel, which had appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, a place which would make any novel respectable and any author noteworthy. In this case, the novel itself was recognized as being, without extraneous help, respectable. Bishop was away up in the public favor, and he was an object of high interest. Consequently, there was a sort of national expectancy in the air. We may say our American millions were standing from Maine to Texas and from Alaska to Florida, holding their breath, their lips parted, their hands ready to applaud when Bishop should get up on that occasion and for the first time in his life speak in public. It was under these damaging conditions that he got up to make good, as the vulgar say. I had spoken several times before, and that is the reason why I was able to go on without dying in my tracks, as I ought to have done. But Bishop had had no experience. He was up facing those awful deities, facing those other people, those strangers, facing human beings for the first time in his life with a speech to utter. No doubt it was well packed away in his memory, no doubt it was fresh and usable, until I had been heard from. I suppose that after that, and under the smothering pall of that dreary silence, it began to waste away and disappear out of his head like the rags breaking from the edge of a fog, and presently there wasn't any fog left. He didn't go on. He didn't last long. It was not many sentences after his first before he began to hesitate and break and lose his grip and totter and wobble, and at last he slumped down in a limp and mushy pile. Well, the program for that occasion was probably not more than one-third finished, but it ended there. Nobody rose. The next man hadn't strength enough to get up, and everybody looked so dazed, so stupefied, paralyzed, it was impossible for anybody to do anything or even try. Nothing could go on in that strange atmosphere. Howells, mournfully and without words, hitched himself to Bishop and me and supported us out of the room. It was very kind. He was most generous. He towed us, tottering away, into some room in that building, and we sat down there. I don't know what my remark was now, but I know the nature of it. It was the kind of remark you make when you know that nothing in the world can help your case. But Howells was honest. He had to say the heartbreaking things he did say. There was no help for this calamity, this shipwreck, this cataclysm. That this was the most disastrous thing that had ever happened in anybody's history. And then he added, "That is for you, and consider what you have done for Bishop. It is bad enough in your case. You deserve to suffer. You have committed this crime, and you deserve to have all you are going to get. But here is an innocent man. Bishop had never done you any harm, and see what you have done to him. He can never hold his head up again. The world can never look upon Bishop as being a live person. He is a corpse." That is the history of that episode of 28 years ago, which pretty nearly killed me with shame during that first year or two, whenever it forced its way into my mind. Now then, I take that speech up and examine it. As I said, it arrived this morning from Boston. I've read it twice, and unless I am an idiot, it hasn't a single defect in it from the first word to the last. It is just as good can be. It is smart. It is saturated with humor. There isn't a suggestion of coarseness or vulgarity in it anywhere. What could have been the matter with that house? It is amazing, it is incredible that they didn't shout with laughter, and those deities the loudest of them all. Could the fault have been with me? Did I lose courage when I saw those great men up there whom I was going to describe in such a strange fashion? If that happened, if I showed doubt, that can account for it, for you can't be successfully funny if you show that you are afraid of it. Well, I can't account for it, but if I had those beloved and revered old literary immortals back here now on the platform at Carnegie Hall, I would take that same old speech, deliver it word for word, and melt them till they'd run all over that stage. Oh, the fault must have been with me. It is not in the speech at all. All Boston shuddered for several days. All gaieties ceased, all festivities. Even the funerals were without animation. There has never been so awful a time in Boston. Even the massacre did not produce a like effect, nor the Anthony Burns episode, nor any other solemnity in Boston's history. But I am glad that that lady mentioned this speech, which I should never have thought of again, I suppose. For now I am going to apply the test, and I am going to find out whether it was Boston or whether it was myself that was in fault at that sad time of Mr. Bishop's obsequies. For next summer I will drop down from the New Hampshire hills with that typewritten ancient speech in my hand, and I will go before the massed intellect of Boston, the 20th Century Club, and without revealing what it is that I am asking permission to talk about, I will lay those ancient facts before that unprejudiced jury and read that speech to them and see what the result will be. If they do not laugh and admire, I shall commit suicide there. I would just as soon do it there as any place, and one time is as good as another to me. Wednesday, January 17, 1906. January 16th continued. About General Sickles. With considerable frequency since then, I have tried to get publishers to make the experiment of such a magazine, but I was never successful. I was never able to convince a publisher that the back number would interest the public. Not one of them was able to conceive of the idea of a sane human being finding interest in stale things. I made my latest effort 3 years ago. Again, I failed to convince. But I myself am not convinced. I am quite sure that the back number would succeed and become a favorite. I am also sure of another thing, that the back number would have this advantage over any other magazine that was ever issued, to wit, that the man who read the first paragraph in it would go on and read the magazine entirely through, skipping nothing. Whereas there is no magazine in existence which ever contains 3 articles which can be depended upon to interest the reader. It is necessary to put 12 articles into a magazine of the day in order to hit 6 or 8 tastes. One man buys the magazine for one of its articles, another is attracted by another by a third. But no man buys the magazine because of the whole of its contents. I contend that the back number would be bought for the whole of its contents and that each reader would read the whole. Mr. Payne, you and I will start that magazine and try the experiment if you are willing to select the ancient news from old books and newspapers and do the rest of the editorial work. Are you willing? Mr. Payne, I should be very willing when we get so that we can undertake it. Very well, then we will by and by make that experiment. Twitchell and I stepped across the street that night in the rain and spent an hour with General Sickles. Sickles is 81 years old now. I had met him only once or twice before, although there has been only the width of 9th Street between us for a year. He is too old to make visits, and I am too lazy. I remember when he killed Philip Barton Key, son of the author of The Star-Spangled Banner, and I remember the prodigious excitement it made in the country. I think it cannot be far from 50 years ago. My vague recollection of it is that it happened in Washington, and that I was there at the time. I have felt well acquainted with General Sickles for 38 or 39 years because I have known Twitchell that long. Twitchell was a chaplain in Sickles's brigade in the Civil War, and he was always fond of talking about the general. Twitchell was under Sickles all through the war. Whenever he comes down from Hartford, he makes it his duty to go and pay his respects to the general. Sickles is a genial old fellow, a handsome and stately military figure, talks smoothly and well-constructed English, I may say perfectly constructed English. His talk is full of interest and bristling with points, but as there are no emphases scattered through it anywhere, and as there is no animation in it, it soon becomes oppressive by its monotony, and it makes the listener drowsy. Twitchell had to step on my foot once or twice. The late Bill Nye once said, "I've been told that Wagner's music is better than it sounds." That felicitous description of a something which so many people have tried to describe and couldn't does seem to fit the general's manner of speech exactly. His talk is much better than it is. No, that is not the idea. There seems to be a lack there somewhere. Maybe it is another case of the sort just quoted. Maybe Nye would say that it is better than it sounds. I think that is it. His talk does not sound entertaining, but it is distinctly entertaining. Sickles lost a leg at Gettysburg, and I remember Twitchell's account of that circumstance. He talked about it on one of our long walks a great many years ago, and although the details have passed out of my memory, I still carry the picture in my mind as presented by Twitchell. The leg was carried off by a cannonball. Twitchell and others carried the general out of the battle, and they placed him on a bed made of boughs under a tree. There was no surgeon present, and Twitchell and Reverend Father O'Hagan, a Catholic priest, made a makeshift tourniquet and stopped the gush of blood. Checked it, perhaps, is the right term. A newspaper correspondent appeared first. General Sickles considered himself a dying man, and if Twitchell is as truthful a person as the character of his cloth requires him to be, General Sickles put aside everything connected with the future world in order to go out of this one in becoming style. And so he dictated his last words to that newspaper correspondent. That was Twitchell's idea. I remember it well, that the general, no doubt influenced by the fact that several people's last words have been so badly chosen, whether by accident or intention, that they have outlived all the rest of the man's fame, was moved to do his last words in a form calculated to petrify and preserve them for the future generations. Twitchell quoted that speech. I've forgotten what it was now, but it was well chosen for its purpose. Now, when we sat there in the general's presence, listening to his monotonous talk, it was about himself, and is always about himself, and always seems modest and unexasperating, inoffensive. It seemed to me that he was just the kind of man who would risk his salvation in order to do some last words in an attractive way. He murmured and warbled and warbled, and it was all just as simple and pretty as it could be. And also I will say this, that he never made an ungenerous remark about anybody. He spoke severely of this and that and the other person, officers in the war, but he spoke with dignity and with courtesy. There was no malignity in what he said. He merely pronounced what he evidently regarded as just criticisms upon them. I noticed then, what I had noticed once before, 4 or 5 months ago, that the general valued his lost leg away above the one that is left. I am perfectly sure that if he had to part with either of them, he would part with the one that he has got. I have noticed the same thing in several other generals who had lost a portion of themselves in the Civil War. There was General Fairchild of Wisconsin. He lost an arm in one of the great battles. When he was consul general in Paris, and we Clemenses were sojourning there some time or other, and grew to be well acquainted with him and with his family, I know that whenever a proper occasion, an occasion which gave General Fairchild an opportunity to elevate the stump of the lost arm and wag it with effect, occurred, that is what he did. It was easy to forgive him for it, and I did it. General Noyes was our minister to France at the time. He had lost a leg in the war. He was a pretty vain man, I will say that for him, and anybody could see, certainly I saw, that whenever there was a proper gathering around, Noyes presently seemed to disappear. There wasn't anything left of him but the leg, which he didn't have. Well, General Sickles sat there on the sofa and talked. It was a curious place, 2 rooms of considerable size, parlors opening together with folding doors, and the floors, the walls, the ceilings cluttered up and overlaid with lion skins, tiger skins, leopard skins, elephant skins. Photographs of the general at various times of life, photographs en civil, photographs in uniform, gushing sprays of swords fastened in trophy form against the wall, flags of various kinds stuck here and there and yonder, more animals, more skins, here and there and everywhere, more and more skins, skins of wild creatures always, I believe, beautiful skins. You couldn't walk across that floor anywhere without stumbling over the hard heads of lions and things. You couldn't put out a hand anywhere without laying it upon a velvety, exquisite tiger skin or leopard skin, and so on. Oh, well, all the kinds of skins were there. It was as if a menagerie had undressed in the place. Then there was a most decided and rather unpleasant odor, which proceeded from disinfectants and preservatives and things such as you have to sprinkle on skins in order to discourage the moths. So it was not altogether a pleasant place on that account. It was a kind of museum, and yet it was not the sort of museum which seemed dignified enough to be the museum of a great soldier, and so famous a soldier. It was the sort of museum which should delight and entertain little boys and girls. I suppose that that museum reveals a part of the general's character and make. He is sweetly and winningly childlike. Once in Hartford, 20 or 25 years ago, just as Twitchell was coming out of his gate Sunday morning to walk to his church and preach, a telegram was put into his hand. He read it immediately, and then, in a manner, collapsed. It said, "General Sickles died last night at midnight." Well, you can see now that it wasn't so, but no matter, it was so to Joe at the time. He walked along, walked to the church, but his mind was far away. All his affection and homage and worship of his general had come to the fore. His heart was full of these emotions. He hardly knew where he was. In his pulpit he stood up and began the service, but with a voice over which he had almost no command. The congregation had never seen him thus moved before in his pulpit. They sat there and gazed at him and wondered what was the matter, because he was now reading, in this broken voice and with occasional tears trickling down his face, what to them seemed a quite unemotional chapter, that one about Moses begat Aaron, and Aaron begat Deuteronomy, and Deuteronomy begat St. Peter, and St. Peter begat Cain, and Cain begat Abel. And he was going along with this and half crying, his voice continually breaking. The congregation left the church that morning without being able to account for this most extraordinary thing, as it seemed to them.
that a man who had been a soldier for more than 4 years and who had preached in that pulpit so many, many times on really moving subjects without even the quiver of a lip should break all down over the begats was a thing which they couldn't understand. But there it is. Anyone can see how such a mystery as that would arouse the curiosity of those people to the boiling point. Twitchell has had many adventures. He has more adventures in a year than anybody else has in five. One Saturday night he noticed a bottle on his wife's dressing bureau. He thought the label said hair restorer, and he took it in his room and gave his head a good drenching and sousing with it and carried it back and thought no more about it. Next morning when he got up, his head was a bright green. He sent around everywhere and couldn't get a substitute preacher, so he had to go to his church himself and preach, and he did it. He hadn't a sermon in his barrel, as it happened, of any lightsome character, so he had to preach a very grave one, a very serious one, and it made the matter worse. The gravity of the sermon did not harmonize with the gaiety of his head, and the people sat all through it with handkerchiefs stuffed in their mouths to try to keep down their joy. And Twitchell told me that he was sure he had never seen his congregation, the whole body of his congregation, the entire body of his congregation, absorbed in interest in his sermon from beginning to end before. Always there had been an aspect of indifference, here and there, or wandering somewhere, but this time there was nothing of the kind. Those people sat there as if they thought, good for this day and train only. We must have all there is of this show, not waste any of it. And he said that when he came down out of the pulpit, more people waited to shake him by the hand and tell him what a good sermon it was than ever before. And it seemed a pity that these people should do these fictions in such a place, right in the church, when it was quite plain they were not interested in the sermon at all. They only wanted to get a near view of his head. Well, Twitchell said, no, Twitchell didn't say, I say, that as the days went on and Sunday followed Sunday, the interest in Twitchell's hair grew and grew. Because it didn't stay merely and monotonously green, it took on deeper and deeper shades of green, and then it would change and become reddish, and would go from that to some other color, purplish, yellowish, bluish, and so on. But it was never a solid color. It was always mottled. And each Sunday it was a little more interesting than it was the Sunday before, and Twitchell's head became famous, and people came from New York and Boston and South Carolina and Japan and so on to look. There wasn't seating capacity for all the people that came while his head was undergoing these various and fascinating mottlings. And it was a good thing in several ways because the business had been languishing a little, and now a lot of people joined the church so that they could have the show, and it was the beginning of a prosperity for that church which has never diminished in all these years. Nothing so fortunate ever happened to Joe as that. Well, he was telling, oh no, it was years ago, that he was telling about the sutler. In the Sickles Brigade was a sutler, a Yankee, who was a wonderful person in the way of competency. All other sutlers got out of things on the eve of battle, during battle, after battle. Not so with this sutler. He never got out of anything, and so he was very greatly respected and admired. There were times when he would get drunk. These were periodical drunks. You couldn't tell when he was going to have an experience of that kind, therefore you did not know how to provide for it. It was very necessary to provide for it, because when he was drunk, he had no respect for anybody's feelings or desires. If he wanted to do so-and-so, he would do it. Nothing could coax him to do some other way. If he didn't want to do a thing, nobody could persuade him to do it. On one of these occasions of sutlerian eclipse, General Sickles had invited some other generals to dine with him in his headquarters tent. His cook or his orderly or somebody, the proper person, came to him aghast and said, "The sutler is drunk. We can't have any dinner. There isn't anything to cook, and the sutler won't sell us anything." "Did you tell him it was General Sickles who wanted these things?" "Yes, sir, it didn't make any difference with the sutler." "Well, can't you get him to—" "No, sir, we can't get him to do anything. We have got some beans, and that is all we have got. We have tried to get him to sell us just a pound of pork for the general, and he says he won't." General Sickles said, "Send for the chaplain. Let Chaplain Twitchell go there. He is popular with that sutler. That sutler has great respect and reverence for Chaplain Twitchell. Let him go there and see if he can't prevail on the sutler to sell him a pound of salt pork for General Sickles." Twitchell went on the errand, stated his errand. The sutler propped himself unsteadily against some kind of a support, collected his thoughts and the suitable words, and said,
Sell you a pound of pork for General Sickles? Nah, go back and tell him I wouldn't sell you a pound of pork for God.
That was Twitchell's story of the episode. But I have wandered from that tree where General Sickles lay bleeding and arranging his last words. It was 3/4 of an hour before a surgeon could be found, for that was a tremendous battle, and surgeons were needed everywhere. When the surgeon arrived, it was after nightfall. It was a still and windless July night, and there was a candle burning. I think somebody sat near the general's head and held this candle in his hand. It threw just light enough to make the general's face distinct, and there were several dim figures waiting around about. Into this group, out of the darkness, bursts an aide, springs lightly from his horse, approaches this white-faced, expiring general, straightens himself up soldier fashion, salutes and reports in the most soldierly and matter-of-fact way that he has carried out an order given him by the general and that the movement of the regiments to the supporting point designated has been accomplished. The general thanked him courteously. I am sure Sickles must have been always polite. It takes training to enable a person to be properly courteous when he is dying. Many have tried it. I suppose very few have succeeded.